Hi folks, hope all is well. This is Jim Carroll welcoming you to the latest Bantercast, a weekly podcast from the team behind the Banter series of talks and events. At Banter, we put on events in spaces and venues of all shapes and sizes up and down the country. We invite a range of interesting people to come along to tell stories, talk about their lives and discuss various topics and themes. We record what happens in the room and then we podcast the results. On Easter Monday last, we took part in the nationwide Crinan na Cosca event with a series of banters in Dublin Castle in association with RTE. In this one, we're talking about critics and assessing their importance at a time when everyone's a critic. With Christine Leach, our critic for the Sunday Times Ireland, Ian Milani, writer and critic for The Wire, The Quietist, The Irish Times and Fellow Media, Graham McLaren, the director of the Abbey Theatre, and Nadine O'Regan, arts editor of the Sunday Business Post, to discuss the role of the critic in 2017 and if arts and culture organisations will actually miss the critic when he or she leaves their free seat for the last time. Hi folks, hope you're all well. Welcome to the second banter here at Dublin Castle as part of Crinan na Cosca. My name is Jim Carroll. This panel is called Everyone's Critic, and it's about examining what's the role of critics and reviewers in 2017 when every single one of you can actually right now go onto Twitter and just say, the moderator's an idiot, this panel sucks, I'm out of here straight away. So in an age when every single person is a critic or reviewer, does the role of a professional critic matter anymore? So we're joined by kind of four people who've got views on this particular topic. At the very end, we have Ian Milani from... He's basically a writer and critic with The Wire, The Quietist, The Irish Times, and he's also editor of Fellow Media. Next to Ian, we have Christine Leach. She is the art critic with Sunday Times Ireland. Next to Christine, we have Nadine O'Regan, who's the arts editor of Sunday Business Post, and she's also a broadcaster with Today FM. And last but by no means least, we've got Graham McLaren, who's not a critic. And Graham is the co-director of the Abbey Theatre here in Dublin, and Graham has will be offering a different view on the role of the critic in 2017. Please give him a round of applause. It's really interesting. Since we announced this panel was happening, there was a lot of kind of interest from critics about it. And there was a very interesting radio essay by Tony Quinn. He's the editor of the Journal of Music in Ireland. He did a radio essay on Arena about this. And he seemed a little bit indignant about the idea of kind of the fact that critics were dying out. So I thought to myself, we'll start with kind of a question to the three professional critics on the panel. And like, what's your view on like the role of the critic right now? Is there still a role for the critic now? Is there a part to be a place for the critic? And what's that place? Nadine?
Well, there's definitely a role for the critic now. For me, there's actually more of a role for the critic than there used to be, almost paradoxically, because we value them less, because so many people are on Twitter or blogs and they're offering critiques. But sometimes those critiques are very coloured by their desire to be present in the media and offering opinions, and that can make them hugely influenced, maybe. I mean, we've seen the case of sort of bloggers who want free products or, you know, so in that respect, if a newspaper hires a journalist to do a review, they act as a very important kind of intermediary between whatever's being covered and the reviewer. So the reviewer has a more objective platform from which to outline their experience. So in that respect, I think the role of the reviewer is really important, and the role of the newspaper or the publication that hires the person is really, really important, because there is an element of, if you like, there's a space or there's a distance. Whereas if you have somebody, and you might see this a lot, where bloggers will email, say, publishers, and they'll say, oh, I would love to review this novel that you have coming out. And then the publisher will send the blogger the novel, and they will immediately feel a kind of kinship, because the publisher has very kindly sent them this book, and they've been contacting them directly. So unfortunately, for the reader who might like to potentially read the novel and wants to know whether or not it's any good, I do think that reviewer that was in such direct contact with the person is to some extent, you know, having their opinion colored or shaped, even when they don't realize it, even when they think they're being totally objective. So for me, the role of the reviewer is really important. Like, one thing I was really sad to see was actually when The View, which was a program that myself and Christine both were contributors to. When that went by the wayside some years back on RTÉ and it was replaced by The Works didn't have as much in the way of a review element in it. And just as a viewer, like, I really missed it. I loved sitting down and watching three people argue over whether something was good or not. And I really believed that they were telling me the truth. I didn't think that they had any axe to grind. I didn't think that they were the cousin of the person who was being reviewed. I believed them, like, 99% of the time. And I loved that TV. I loved watching it. I loved, you know, maybe going out to buy something because I trusted them. And trust is really important.
Okay, so that's trust and distance. What about you, Christine? Is there anything you can add to that in terms of a place for the critic in 2017?
Yeah, well, that idea of critical distance is something that you have when you have a professional critic, as Nadine is saying. And I think one of the reasons the professional critic is something of an endangered species right now, and it's to do with the wider context in which we operate, and that's to do with mainstream media still trying to figure out a financial model for itself as print is declining and all of that. So what you find now is, in the past, you might have had staff critics for newspapers who might have had long tenure, a lot of experience, had seen a lot of work and had a lot of ideas about context that the work existed in, and that is disappearing because staff critics have been replaced by freelancers. Freelancers tend to be paid at the bottom rung, and you don't get people to stay, I think, to keep doing that job over a long period of time if there's no opportunity to progress or have a more secure income. So that has affected the type of, not only the outlet for the criticism, but the type of critic you might get and whether or not a critic is going to stay for a long time doing that job when there's no job security in it, when there's no, you know. So that's all to do with the bigger problem we have about how to pay for media and people and the general public and whether or not they're willing to fund journalism, pay for content and all of that. So, of course, you have websites and blogs where there's free content and, you know, I think the public has ceased to discern the difference between the two, and so that is also an issue for someone who might want to be a professional critic. So this is the landscape we're operating in. So I think we're something of an endangered species, but we're absolutely critical and really important. This is what I feel. But I think we're at a difficult time for criticism, actually. Yeah.
Talking about that changed landscape that Christine is talking about there, Ian, you know, you write for kind of like people like The Quietist, The Wire, The Resident Advisor. Like, I mean, these are with exception of The Wire, they're largely kind of like online magazines, online publications. It strikes me that, like, I mean, when we'll turn to, I suppose, in the time talking about the mainstream media and less space there for kind of critical voices, these outlets have umpteen space for critical voices, and like, it's really good in terms of curating what's going on. What's your take from your position on where we stand right now?
I suppose being the only one here without a staff position.
I'm not staff, it's freelance.
Freelance.
15 years.
Unfortunately, again.
Yeah. Your point's still valid, though.
Well, as a freelancer, I say, like, you are the bottom rung, really, when it comes to things. But I do think there's an opportunity there to move between places and not kind of get stuck into a beat as quickly as you might be expected to do so in a staff position. So, you know, I think there's a lot of very good criticism and a lot of very good writing happening outside of publications that have the ability to offer you a job, basically, and they can take in different types of people who maybe are doing something else but have a valid position and valid take on something. So, you know, it is an exciting time, I think, in lots of ways, in that there's a lot of very different types of writing happening. And part of that is down to, like, an example like The Quietist, which doesn't really pay for very much of its content, and what it does pay for doesn't pay very much money for. So you're kind of just doing it because it's an open space, and you can try something out, and you can try different voices, or you can talk about stuff that is never going to get talked about elsewhere. So I think, in that respect, like, there's just huge value in those places, regardless of there's money or not.
I also think it's quite important to kind of like point out as well that these new spaces as well, they're creating audiences, and this is something that, like, I mean, certainly from the critic's point of view, it's like there are audiences out there. So, like, I mean, you know, even in kind of like online spaces that may not necessarily have the same sort of volume or same sort of amplification as kind of Sunday Business Post or the Sunday Times or whoever, or the Irish Times, these publications are building audiences all at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, they're totally, like, niche audiences a lot of the time, you know. But they cross barriers a lot quicker. They don't have to have this pressure to cover something that's happening now or something that's popular right now. They can just cover whatever they want, and they can get really, really good at covering those things.
Okay, so that's the case for the defence. Let's turn to the prosecution, Graham.
Well, I don't know how I've been casting this role.
No. I'm just curious from your point of view, because I know you've got you would look at the critics in a different way, but like, these days, when you're kind of putting a show on the Abbey, when you open a show on the Abbey, you know, does the fact that like you've got a Niamh O'Kelly or a kind of like Peter Crawley or like a Sophie Gorman coming down to review the show, what they have to say, does that have a big say in how you kind of market the show, or does it matter as much?
As you know, I'm a new boy.
That's no excuse.
No, in that I'm just not certain. I can give you an absolute answer on this. But I've been making theatre for a long time, and I have got a sense in which I think it's a non-starter as a question. I think there's too many moving parts. I think for some shows it's essential a good review, and other shows it matters less. What's important is the critical discourse around the work, and. And the thought of that going is what we should all be worrying about, and I am worried about it. It's not, with respect, it's not. I hate the idea that you can reduce a Tom Murphy play to, you know, 5 stars, 4 stars, 3. You can, but in a way that was the thin end of it, you know. And so for me, what I miss is exactly that, the discourse, 3 people kind of battling it out. On radio or on television, or in print, I want thousands of words discussed. You know, the idea that you can do it, you can sum it up with 500 words and put 2 stars on it, like it. Now that's insane, and it doesn't help the industry, or the critics, or indeed the artists. And what I really think that what we're seeing here is like. It's the dying embers of the print media shedding anything that it thinks it can, you know, dispense, you know, thrown overboard, all of that stuff. And of course, we all now have to, I think, collectively find a new way for new platforms. And it's all allowed. I think bloggers, it doesn't matter to me if they're a 15-year-old and they have a thesis and they want to write about the show. But I do think that people can tell the difference between, you know, someone's sister-in-law writing a really good review and serious discourse. And we search them out. We do the world over. It was a real worry to the theatre world all over the English-speaking world when Lynn Gardner blogs get taken away from The Guardian. You know, it's not that I agree with what Lynn says, but she has to. We have to have the platforms to discuss this, and critics are a crucial part of that. That discourse, I think.
Yeah. Okay, so like, you know, that you've made kind of like, mean you've two differentiation there between like, mean the review with the kind of like the 5 stars that your marketing department love because they can put on a poster, and the critical discourse which is a lot deeper. Let's talk about the critical discourse then. You know, from your point of view, two of you, like Chrissy and Nadine, from the newspaper's point of view, do you think there's still space for that? Is there still a demand for that? Is there still kind of like, are there kind of like budgets there from managing editors to allow you to do this? Are the readers there as well?
Well, I mean, I suppose from the perspective of the budgets, the thing that makes me really sad is, I mean, I've been in my position in the Business Post as arts editor for coming up on actually 10 years now. And the thing that really upsets me is that I used to have a great pool of like freelance people, really gifted writers, able to turn things around really fast and really good at their craft. And one by one, they're sort of slowly slipping away because the rates for what they do are decreasing. They don't have as much space as they used to, and they have to take other jobs. They just have to take other jobs. So I'd ring them and they'd be like, I'd love to do it, but I can't do it. And then they're being, you know, so I get other people in and all that, but to some extent, and I'd agree with you, by the way, there's some amazing bloggers out there, and I'd hate for a minute to think that I was sort of tarring everybody with the same brush. But actually, blogging culture, again, is slightly different because it's online culture, and there's a smaller, they're used to writing fewer words in a different style. So when you bring them into a print culture, they write in a more informal style. They might not be used to writing thousands and thousands of words. They might be used to writing 250. So it's different. Mm-hmm. It's harder. But I think there's a huge space and there's huge value in critique. I mean, I was very critical of the Abbey Theatre prior to your tenure. And it's funny because the response back to the articles that I wrote in regard to the Abbey really showed how much people cared about their national theatre, and also how much they cared about they wanted to be engaged in that debate. They wanted, and there were, you know, counter arguments, and people got involved. And actually, you know, the Abbey wasn't too thrilled at a certain point. I realised I got blocked on email.
Yeah, really? Sent an email
blocked.
Unblock her, please.
No, I found a way around. I created a new email address. I was like, oh, it's
good
my Gmail account.
Good work.
But look, I mean, I understand that. I understand there would be negativity attached to criticism, and I knew that that was happening. But at the same time, this was around the sort of the Waking the Feminists kind of time around 2015, when a really important sort of cohort of women emerged to say, look, there isn't equality in terms of the apportioning of jobs relating to gender. And it is, and you know, it was and remains a very important debate and something that needs to be brought up and out into the open. And newspapers play a huge role in bringing to life that debate and also giving it weight. Because the terrible thing about blogs is, no matter how gifted, I'm sure some of you are doing blogs, but the problem is it's about validation. If you have the Sunday Business Post, the Sunday Times, you know, the Irish Times, that platform itself lends gravitas. So it means that your bosses and everyone involved said, no, we believe this is important. And that in itself, even if it's negative, lifts the institutions that are being discussed. So, I mean, I think the role of the critic is vital.
Okay. So again, Christine, you talk a little bit about the Sunday Times, and when you're the visual arts critic, so like, I mean, you've piece in most weeks, right? So when you're talking to John Burns, your commissioning editor, about this, like, what's he looking for? Is he looking for something that's populist? Is he trusting your opinion because you've been your beat for so long? You know those people.
A few things occurred to me kind of to do with that. So one is, if you're writing for a blog or a smaller publication, then they're more likely to let you go to some obscure venue somewhere and write about something that isn't maybe well known to the general public. If you're writing for a newspaper like the Sunday Times, what I do is I pitch to the editor all the time. So I pitch various shows and he'll select one. And editors make decisions based on various criteria, and they include things like, will this look good on a two-page colour spread? As in, are the visual images that this artist has produced enough to catch the reader's eye? And that might not be entirely related to how the merit of the work, or, you know, I mean, there may be work that I would like to write about and could write very interestingly about, but visually it's not going to look good on a two-page spread. So the editor will say no. He's also looking at whether it's a venue that people can get to, whether it's something people already know about, or maybe it's a name that will catch the eye. Because the reality of writing for the culture section, say, is that that is a section of the paper that's full of interviews with movie stars and musicians and all sorts of people. And people are turning the pages, and you want them to stop and read what you've written. So you're not going to write something difficult, obscure, you know. No one owes you their time. Nobody owes you the time to read the stuff. So the other point about it is, the critic owes the reader good writing. So this is what I think is really important, and it comes back to that thing of nurturing a critic, giving them space over time, and working with an editor. Because when you're blogging, you're not working with an editor necessarily. Well, you aren't if it's your own blog, but you know, and a lot of these... Also, new models for newspapers have people uploading content too without the layer of editing. Editing improves the writing over time, and a good relationship with an editor hones somebody's voice, their skill. And the better the writing is, the more you build up a following for your criticism, and the more people will say, oh, well, I don't know what this is that this person's writing about, but I know they write well, or I enjoy what they write, and I'm going to read it. But even at that, you're not going to get anyone past the first paragraph or two if you haven't engaged them. So it's, in ways... It's a constant sort of not battle, that's too big a word, but you know, it's a play back and forth between grabbing someone's attention and keeping it. And if you're going to write 1,500 words, is pretty much what you've got in a two-page spread. If you're going to keep the attention of someone who is in a Twitter kind of clickbait world over that period of time, you know, it has to be worth reading, otherwise you're wasting the paper. So this is all part of it. The Sunday Times has, for a very long time, really supported and continues to support the idea of pure criticism. So a lot of other newspapers, as they've moved, you know, towards not having staff critics, employ freelancers to write features, interview-based pieces, more lifestyle-y type pieces, so maybe visiting an artist's studio or talking to them about some other aspect of their life, or a piece that's maybe driven more by images of the artist doing something, or, you know, they're more lifestyle-y. So I think the space for pure criticism that just engages with the work is being squashed. And it's important, as Graham said, to have more of that, because if you only have one review of a show, it's almost as if this is the only opinion that's been put out there. And what we need is more critics, more reviews, more space for that.
Yeah. I mean, this brings me back kind of to Fellow Media, and Ian, the publication you edit online, you know, and you've got space there for, like, again, it's online, so there's infinite space, you know. Talk a little bit about the editing process, just especially what Christine was kind of saying there about keeping the reader's attention, keeping the reader's attention for something that sometimes more than 1,500 words.
Well, it's kind of different because, like, it's one piece a month, basically, is the kind of rate with that, and it's every piece that goes up on it is kind of an experiment in terms of how it looks and what type of writing might be and whether it interacts with audio or video or whatever the technology involved is. So, and because it's just me, to be totally honest, keeping someone's attention is, if it keeps my attention, then that's enough.
Yeah. Like, but are you finding as well that, like, I mean, the pieces are building up an audience out there?
I think so. Because it's slow and because each piece looks different and feels different, and I think people appreciate something that isn't just a basic WordPress with, you know, the same layout every time and everything. So I think people come back even if they don't know the writers or if they don't know even the subject. You know, that they're drawn in by how it looks and how it feels and why it's different or something like that. They might never come back, but I don't track anybody, so I don't know.
Right. Okay. So I want to kind of circle back to kind of something that you've all mentioned in one way, shape, or form, and that's kind of like the aspect of money and the aspect of actually paying for having critics on the beat, paying for pieces to appear. You know, you mentioned there, Nadine, very interesting about, like, I mean, the fact that you can't keep a retinue of kind of like good freelancers because the rates aren't attractive anymore. You know, it's like you've said you're a freelancer as well, so it's like we know that the amount of pages are kind of going down all the time. What, like, I mean, and this is applies to you as well, Graham, like, I mean, have you seen any particular models in terms of kind of like, I suppose, business models for keeping critics employed, keeping critics kind of like paid and paying them for their work so we can maintain this critical discourse you talked about?
So for me?
Any of you?
Well, in terms of maintaining people in their careers, I suppose I would have developed relationships with some of the freelancers I work with to try and help them on and like find other spots, do you know what I mean? So because I work in radio as well, I was doing an art show first for Phantom, then for TXFM, and now I work with Today FM, and I would often almost, it became like this really interesting, like, if you got somebody in for their radio show and they were really good and they were working and writing, it's like, oh, well, maybe I could try them out for the paper. And then the rates were different, you know, depending on which area they were working in, but they could become somebody that I'd sort of be able to sort of say, well, look, I know this person is very good and there might be a multiplicity of ways. And then I would always recommend them for the money gigs. Like, there's some money gigs out there and we all can know. It's like getting good parking spots or whatever. You're like, right, okay, we know this one pays well. So, like, you try and recommend. Like, I've got, like, a few people who, if I know that they were freelance and that they were good, so if anyone rang me from RTE or from wherever saying we need someone, I would always be like, right, this person, this person, this person, and there's a community and a good spirit actually amongst that sort of fraternity, as well as, you know, I mean, people think about it in the context of artists, maybe making albums, or with regard to theatre practitioners, you know, sharing spaces to bring something to life, but actually with journalists as well, and I was a freelance journalist for 7 years starting out, you know, you do realise that there are ways to keep each other afloat, and I think that's very important. So it's not a complete answer, but the other thing is the fight. Like, we're always, the more vocal you are about the fact that it's difficult, the pushback is important. And actually, something I should say in relation to, I was talking about Waking the Feminist there earlier, there was so much you know, life and spirit brought into the Waking the Feminist movement. That, like, I went to see The Train, which is on in the Abbey Theatre at the moment, last week, and it was amazing to see how that production had incorporated some of the criticism that had been levelled at the Abbey in recent times into that production. So you could actually feel the sort of feminist spirit coming out from the Abbey Theatre. And in a way, to me, what it displayed was that if you fight on behalf of something you believe in, whether it's the role of the critic, that there should be critics, or whether it's, you know, gender orientated, you can achieve a result. So we actually need to be talking about the rates that are being paid or not paid to critics, because it is unfair. It's going down and down and down, and the role is being devalued as a result. Books pages are being shifted to the back of publications. You know, we have to be vocal about this, because otherwise it's going to disappear from our pages.
Mm. Graham?
I mean, for me, it's the difference between what you're talking about and lobbying for you know, rates and something like Waking the Feminist. I mean, essentially, the big difference is economics. Newspapers are, you know, privately owned, and in the end, if someone's not turning a buck, doesn't matter what you say, and there is no sense in which there's public accountability. And there is for a national theatre, and it's incumbent upon the national theatre to make space for that platform. What I think, and this is a contentious thing, and I haven't ever really, I've never said it out loud, and so what better place to say it when I'm on? I think there's a kind of subsidy that could be found, or should be found, or should be looked into. We subsidise all kinds of other endeavours. Mm. And I wonder if public money isn't found to subsidise proper critical discourse. Because if we are always in the hands of you know, the media tycoons who say, well, it doesn't matter how good your writing is, you're cut, because I need to make, you know, my profit margin, you know, is dwindling, so you're going to have to go. And if we value it, and that's the question in the end, if we really value it, surely there's an argument. Wouldn't it be great if it was Ireland that started this, where we said, you know what, we're going to subsidise a critical discourse, which is not the same. And you know, if I had an opinion about this, it's not the same as like a 3-star review, you know, 50 words or 250 words. No, proper critical discourse, because it is without that we have, it's all much poorer. Mm. And so I totally agree with you, but I think you'll find that you help another journalist by giving
it's
them,
informal,
you know,
yeah.
And in the end, it goes for nothing, and you'll be, you know, you're at the mercy of like, you know, essentially kind of capitalist, neoliberal kind of economics.
I want to throw that question out to Christine, but just I suppose kind of like encapsulated what both kind of Graham and Nadine were talking about, in that. One, what you're proposing there about like the subsidy, would that actually work? I could see immediately a way of working would be through the RT license fee for a start. And second of all, do you think the audience realise how badly paid critics and freelancers are, or do they care?
I don't know if they realise. I presume that they don't. Do they care? I think we don't know that we value something till it's gone. So, you know, and that's true of everything.
Don't
So if you look at, say, the Arts Council used to fund publications that did provide platforms. So Irish Theatre Magazine and Circa Magazine for the visual arts, gone. So those were like publications of record, I suppose. Yeah. And this is the other thing for artists, all types of artists, if there is no written assessment, no critical discourse around the work, once the exhibition is gone, once the play is over, artists have said to me often, it's like it never happened, it's like it didn't exist. So there is that other layer of the role for the critic, which is to produce almost archival work, you know, documentation almost, of a particular type, but of a very valuable type, because it adds to the whole cultural fabric of our society. It's mm-hmm. part of our history. It's part of all of our, you know, it's really important. So there's a role for RTE, and to bring back something like The View, where there is active, animated dissenting opinions about something, I think would be really important and is really important. I'd love to see RTE doing that, finding that space for that. But also there's a role for the Arts Council to fund those types of publications. I think Irish Theatre Magazine used to cover almost every play that ever happened.
Yeah.
You know, so that was absolutely so valuable, and it's gone. And for Circa Magazine, for the visual artists, because a Sunday newspaper, if you have four Sundays in the month, you've got four exhibitions covered there. There are a hell of a lot more exhibitions happening than that. So yes, we do need some sort of state support, you know, but probably not for the journalists who are writing for the newspapers, but maybe for other outlets, for other spaces. We need a whole new model for newspapers anyway.
Yeah.
So, maybe there's a way of looking at adding critical writing into the tax exemption as writing for the artist tax exemption, you know, because that doesn't count, or, you know, something. I don't know. Maybe there is a way of supporting critics financially in a tax way. You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, there are lots of...
Why not? I mean, genuinely, why not?
Why not? Why not? If the rates are so small for criticism and you're being paid per word as you are, maybe we could value that type of writing as a type of creative discourse. You know,
It is.
Well, I believe in criticism itself as a really important discipline. I think it's really important. Mm. But the other aspect of this is we're not teaching it. We're not teaching critical thinking. We're not teaching analytical thinking to children in schools. And so that's all part of the wider culture around all of this. So I've recently started doing some third level lecturing about just criticism skills. How to write critically about the visual arts or about anything else. And those are skills that we're lacking, even in an environment where people have access to Twitter and blogs and can throw their opinions out there all the time. It's not nuanced, it's not always thought out.
And do you ever get somebody coming up to you after you do an interview or a review or something, and they come up and they go, but what did you really think? And you're like, no, it's what I put down.
No,
so that's
I get
what
people,
I really think.
Get people arguing with me. What I get a lot of the time is people telling me I'm covering the wrong stuff. Why aren't you looking at this? Why aren't you looking at this? Why aren't you looking at this? And my answer is I pitch the stuff to the editor and the editor makes the decisions. Mm. And that's the model I work in.
Yeah.
You know?
Let's pull back to kind of something that we've all mentioned in passing, which is social media, you know, and the fact that, like, I mean, thanks to Twitter and Instagram, you know, you can get those instant reviews up, those the equivalent of the kind of 5-star reviews of the latest Tom Murphy play. Has that in some ways kind of like cheapened how critics are seen by the audience? So suddenly, anyone can go to a play at the halftime interval, then come out and go, that's absolutely shite, I wouldn't go anywhere near it. Or is it like, you know, in an age where clickbait seems to be kind of so prominent, in an age when we're looking for kind of like fast news, that for many people will do the trick?
I think that people can tell the difference. I mean, I think there's a place for it. And, you know, if you go, the sixth form in that school thought it was brilliant. However, you know, the Sunday Times critic thought it was rubbish. You know, and it's all right. It's all, in the end, it's the discourse. It's a bit between those.
Do you think as well, because sometimes when I'm reading review, I'm like, I know Jim is going to like his electronica. He's going to be, you know, like all his stuff is going to be a little bit more niche interest sometimes.
Yeah. We're going to get defensive here.
You know, you'd love that kind of stuff. And then if you're reading Camilla Long in the Sunday Times, I cannot make up my mind about, because I think some of her critiques are extraordinarily harsh and they're of films that I would have seen as well that I just don't see where she's coming from. And then there are people who, Michiko Kakutani in the New York Times, I'm always very interested in her reviews, her book reviews, and Janet Maslin, and there are people that I kind of know where I stand with them, you know, I read them and I go, well, he's a bit more to the left than me in terms of his, he's more into the electronica bleepy bleepy world, and...
That's going on my business card.
And this person is a little bit more sort of, you know, likes their sort of cheeseburger style arts, and when I'm reading, I have a relationship with the reviewer, you know, I know, Peter Crawley, you know, whether or not I'm going to love something that he also loves. There's so many different reviewers out there that I place kind of different levels of, I suppose, trust, not depending on, because I rate them, but it's more like going, well, where does my taste stand in relation to theirs? So, you know, I love that relationship that I have, not just with the subject that's being reviewed, but with the critic that's doing the reviewing.
And you only get that when there is longevity, and when there's space for somebody to continue doing this over a period of time and build a relationship with the reader or the listener or the viewer. And if you have freelancers coming in and out, the audience doesn't get an opportunity to build up that relationship, because you might have a favorite critic who you always disagree with, but you love reading them because they're you know, what they write is entertaining or fun, or you love their style, or, you know, and you might enjoy the fact that you always disagree with them, you know. Mm. Some people read a negative review and say, well, I'm definitely going to see that now because,
well, like Liam Fay.
Because they said it was rubbish.
But but Liam Fay is a really good example in the Sunday Times. I mean, I've actually, because he's known as being like a critical Rottweiler, so everybody expects that he will hate everything. So I've interviewed people after Liam Fay has given like a really bad review to something they've done, and they're like, it wasn't as bad as what he did to the person the previous week, so we were actually quite happy. And you're like, okay.
It's a lot easier to do those stinking reviews, though.
That's another form of criticism, and it doesn't pretend to be. It presents itself as that. There is, you know, the fun of reading it is part of it, you know. But that's also to do with giving the critic a space to build up a persona over time, you know.
Yeah. I think that in my mind, it's the eradication of that space and the eradication of that beat. You know, the fact that someone could spend a couple of years just like learning. I'm learning in public, writing in public about this particular area, and therefore you build up an expertise. You know, you may not agree with what the person is saying, but you kind of know, at least they know their audience when it comes to that. Mm.
Well, you know, it was very difficult. I'm sure some of you read Eileen Battersby's review of Paul Murray's follow-up to Skippy Dies, which was called The Mark in the Void, his novel, and she gave it an incredibly harsh review that went on to be talked about and talked about and talked about. And like, I'd read the same novel and loved it. And, you know, it was actually sometimes, like, when you think about power, like, how much power does a critic have? Can a critic actually kill a novel stone dead? And in recent years, that's the closest I've come to seeing a critic actually take something out into the backyard and shoot it full of holes. Because I'd read and loved the same book, and I was reading it going, oh my God. And then people were coming up going, well, you know, and...
But see, this is the thing.
He spent years on that book.
But also... is this what the audience want from their critics? Did the audience want us to kind of like take the novel out of the back and just kill it, or do they actually want this kind of like this critical discourse we're talking about? Because the critical discourse is something that every single person on the stage adheres to. This is what we want. This is what we want, that space to kind of get into it. But maybe the reader just wants to know they've killed it. It's great. It's a great review. There's some snappy one-liners in it.
Well, you see, the thing that I have issues with, I think negative critiques are extremely important, and it's something that has to be part of the discourse, because without honesty, how can you proceed? But where I do have a problem is where a review becomes so personalized. You know, I will always take out, if somebody sends me in a review for editing, and there's a line in it that goes, not only is this a terrible book, but it's such a terrible book that I feel bad and sorry for the person that wrote it, and also this person is never going to write a good book ever, ever, ever in their lives. I'm like, whoa, you know, because you can't say what's going to happen in the future. And also, you know, there's an element of personalized critique that's really, really uncomfortable, you know, like, I don't think should be in the pages of newspapers like that. But you will see it. You will definitely see it. And so, you know, like, I don't go for the sort of bland endorsement of everything, but neither do I think that you should have sort of the reviewer Rottweilers that, you know, almost revel in tearing stuff up and in kind of a wild froth.
Yeah, in the end, if you feel that the critic is the star of the piece, then that's, you know, that's where I think I start to have a problem, you know, where it's my opinion is so important that, you know, it's hard. I would say the same of the artists as well. You know, it is a much more collaborative and kind of and subtle thing. And so I sometimes, you know, I switch off. I have to say, I don't engage too heavily with reviews as such, but I do, and that's why I miss something like Lynn Gardner's kind of massive blogs, because there's context being discussed, there's a movement, there's an understanding of a whole kind of range of issues which are feeding into why the work is the way it is and what it's attempting to do. And it's that I miss, really, and I see less and less of. Even on, like, Sunday night television. We used to see more of that.
That was a kind of brings another question. Like, I mean, are the days of kind of like mean critics like John Berger, people like that, over? Those kind of people who can kind of like cover such an area, are those days where you can have someone who can actually hold the attention of kind of like maybe people who don't think there's interest in the arts and culture as they really are? Are those days over where you have that
those
kind of voice?
Those people are still there. It's just that the platforms are not being given to them. Mm. They're here. We're here. You know, it's just that there's people are not.
Well, the podcast sometimes is the way to go. I mean, Mark Kermode discussing film is just riveting listening, and he discusses, he'll take a film and discuss it at length, and you will, it's just such a pleasurable experience to hear him outline, as you were saying, the context, and there's no sense of hurry, that it's not like a five-minute review on as part of a small arts program, and then you have to go on to the next thing, the next thing, the next thing, because the other thing about our culture is that it's become so bite-sized, because everybody's making art, you know, everybody has a blog, everybody has made an album in their bedroom, and a lot of people are really, really good, so you want to get in as much as you can, but in getting in as much as you can, are you losing something really vital, that long-form piece? Maybe. Yeah.
Well, we're living in an era now where there's so much information. Where, you know, I don't think we've ever lived at a time where human beings had instant access to this much information. So it's information overload. So we also have to operate a sense of self-curation. We're curating what we do pay attention to and don't pay attention to. And so one of the ways that the critics can keep, I suppose, an audience for what they do is by like ending up with a personal relationship where somebody seeks out your work over the other work that exists. But the other thing about it is nothing stays the same. Everything changes, you know. So the environment is changing for criticism, but, you know, everything changes. So technology is changing, how the audience interacts with the content is changing, the type of art that's being produced is changing. Everything is changing all the time. So we just have to keep responding to that. And we also need to make sure we don't lose what's important within it. So maybe the format is no longer going to be 1,500 words about this, maybe it's going to be somebody walking around a gallery talking to their phone as they're talking about the work. You know, who
Snapchat
knows?
Snapchat reviews,
yeah. Who knows? But I think good work will rise to the top. So good writing, people will seek it out. And as long as people keep seeking it out, we'll keep producing it. But I mean, that's notwithstanding the financial difficulties,
etc. What I'm getting from all of you here then is that the critic may be an endangered species, but it ain't going anywhere.
But it's always been the case, isn't it?
I don't know. I mean, you said something earlier on. You said kind of like, I mean, you only miss it when it's gone, you know. And like you talked there about that Guardian blog, for example, you know, and you miss that kind of like that long form, that kind of attention to detail over time. And I suppose more and more, I'm thinking like that's what you're going to miss. That slowly everything's been kind of like being taken away. Nadine talked there about like being less budget, like being to bring in kind of freelancers. You've all talked about that. That it's slowly been chipped away. That maybe it's a case of that like we're already missing what we actually had before.
Well, it's, you know, it's kind of common to say, oh, things were better before, weren't they? So, you know, like, okay. Say, oh, you know, the good old days. Oh, yeah. But, you know, we do need to acknowledge that blogging, new voices, writers who seek out things that the mainstream media might not be covering, that's all important, and it's coming up. And those people in their early 20s are the people in their mid-40s of the future. So, you know, it's, you know, this is all, and they're just starting out and developing new formats, new audiences. So we don't know where it's going, you know.
There's a group process as well where it's almost like, I hate to say it, but it's a bit like, you know, when you're trying to see where you'll stay in, like, I don't know, Ibiza or something, and you go on to your little TripAdvisor. Like, when I'm thinking of going to see something now, you know, I will do this little sort of online look and go to the people I trust or get sort of sense of a critical mass of opinion around something. And that will inform. It's like you're saying, you have to use your own critical faculties to sort of discern whether or not, you know, you buy into what is online or what's before you. But you're kind of engaging with it in that way as well. Like that it's almost like this mass of opinion rather than before. It'd be like, I buy the one paper. This is the one critic. This is the voice. There is no one voice in exactly the same way anymore, but there's a multiplicity of voices. So if you use your kind of, you know, your own intellect to bring to bear on that, you can still, you know, get this idea of what to go to and what you'd love.
Graham?
I thought it just occurred to me there, it was just about, maybe it's a little dark for this conversation, but I'm going to say it, it seems to me some ways linked to, you know, budgets for education, and you know, I look at the I look at the dumbing down of the electorate across the planet. You know, look at what's happening in the UK and what's happening in America, and I see a kind of lowest common denominator kind of culture, and in a way, maybe the dark thought that I had was that I want to share with you is that maybe it's part of a not an explicit strategy, but a strategy to just to take away, you know, that thing that was a couple of years ago. We've had enough of experts. We've had enough of clever people. Oh, that Obama guy, he's got books. He's clearly mental. And that kind of thing, I'm wondering if it's just all part of that to devalue this. And that's a... that's a horrible thought to have had as I was listening to you thinking about Ibiza.
but it is the rise of anti-intellectualism, which has been sort of very omnipresent in the last few years.
I suppose the question is, do you think that, you know, what we're seeing here with critical discourse is part of that?
Well, I think that the world of culture and critique generally is sort of splintering off into a million different sort of... niche areas, if you like, so that nobody listens to the same band anymore. In the 1990s, you were a Blur or you were an Oasis fan, or you were a Nirvana or you were a Pearl Jam fan, or, you know, but there were these kind of, you know, everybody was engaged, and when you went to the concert and the band was on the stage, you faced the band. Now, most people, and I go to festivals all the time, so Longitude, everyone's facing away from the band, they're facing towards their phone, and they're doing the selfie with, you know, the band as the backdrop. So what the band are actually looking out onto, which is really sad, is people with their backs turned to them. Like at Longitude last year, I got stopped by the security guards on the way in, and they were like, oh, you can't bring that with you. They took this thing out of my bag. I said, why can't I bring this with me? They're like, it's not permitted. And I said, sorry. I said, what do you think this is? And they're like, it was like the silver thing, and they were like, it's a selfie stick. And I was like, it's a fountain pen. I'm reviewing.
You were disgusted, weren't you?
I've got this vision of you and your wellies and a fountain pen up the back.
But like, I just put it in my bag, and I had a good laugh with the security lady over it, and I was just like, I am too old for this festival.
I want to get a couple of voices from the audience, like before we finish. Anyone any questions in the audience? Excellent. Oh. Here.
I was just going to say that I've been following Jarnet Regan's podcast. It's great. He looks at a couple of different artists across the industry, and he talks them through how they got to where they come from. It's really interesting. He kind of does an hour of whoever it is. But I've listened to Emmett Kerwin's episode lately, and it was like, it's brilliant. I absolutely have great respect for him as an artist, and he's really got his voice out there. But one of the things he said was he believes theatre is one of the last forums for change. That he finds with TV, there's only so much you can do. There's so many different things, like that the arts industry, there's not really much left to create a bit of friction and to bring the real issues out there. So I don't know why you're opening your head to that.
I think that's absolutely, I think Emmett's completely right. I think what makes theatre dangerous, which is why dictators, you know, close it down, is that it's a civic space. Where we, a couple of hundred of us, get in a room, turn the lights out, and talk about difficult stuff. And there's a moment for change. And personally, that's why I came to Ireland, uprooted my family and my life, and to come here, because if there's ever a place that has happened regularly, it's the Abbey. The Abbey has had, you know, of course we can talk about the riots, but it has been fundamental to Ireland's understanding of itself and growing, shaping its society. And Emmett's right that it's potentially explosive what can happen in the theatre. That's why we have to take that space very seriously, you know, literally as a civic, socially responsible and good fun and all of that. But it's not like a congregation. People think, oh yeah, you know, as an audience is like a congregation. It's really not. It's not it's a much more complicit thing. So I think he's right, and I would like to think that that there would be more of that work. Certainly, that's what I'm interested in.
He's a huge talent as well. I mean, his YouTube videos have been amazing. What was the recent one? The name of the just won an award. But Emma Kirwan, like, he's one of the people that you would see as being sort of an arts practitioner through vocation. He also makes his living as a voiceover artist.
Oh,
so
yeah.
He's one of those people that is finding a way, you know? Like, a lot of people do hybrid kind of work these days. They work in different... Some things pay the bills, and some things are done for love. And I think maybe, in a very strange way, maybe the critic will almost become... come to see that particular job as a vocation more than a post, if you like. That, you know, the way, Ian, you were describing sort of that you want to write, and you want to write in an experimental way if you can. Like, that to me sounds more like what, you know, we think of as an artist doing, you know, because there's always been this separation, hasn't there? That, like, the critic is seen as almost, you know,
ditch.
The little flea on the back picking away. So maybe it
I don't think
it's all right. I think that is kind of part of it now.
Well, I think now a lot of the best critics are artists themselves, particularly in the visual arts, where you have people who have spent a long time, they've come into art through theory or through college or whatever, however they've gotten into it. You know, they are the people who are putting forth the best critiques of their own art, either in the form of critique itself or in the form of a piece of work. So I think any idea at this point of a clear division between the two, you know, even take Eileen Battersby, like, she's a novelist as well as a critic, and she knows what goes into it. And I think to maintain some sort of relationship between the two is good for a critic, because you realize how hard it is and how bad you might be at it yourself. Mm-hmm. And it's good for artists too, because they realize they can take a step back from the work and say, well, maybe this isn't as good as I thought it was.
Mm-hmm. Is there a danger, given, like, I mean, all the kind of shifting sands that are going on in criticism right now, that many people may be quite happy to, or it may become the case, that criticism has left academia?
If criticism
has left academia, that suddenly becomes the case. Because you mentioned something earlier on, Christine, you're talking about, like, I mean, a body of work that was being created, almost like an archive, you know, a paper record. Then maybe we're getting to a situation where criticism, in the case we're talking about earlier on, that critical discourse, that suddenly becomes something for academia.
I think if that was to happen, it would be very dangerous. And there's absolutely an important space within academia for critical discourse. It's a different type of critical discourse to the type that engages with the general public. And so that's where journalism comes into it. So criticism as journalism is a very particular type of criticism. It's written in a different way to academic criticism. And one of the difficulties you have when you have artists coming to write about the visual arts who have come from an academic background is they have a tendency to, because this is their training and their origins, to write in an academic way, because they have their background is to be presenting the work to an audience within a university or within a college, to their peer group, who also have that theory, experience or knowledge. And so criticism as journalism is a different function, and it's a bridge between the audience that isn't part of that world. So if your background is in the visual arts and you come from an academic background and you're writing on your blog about the arts, you're speaking to a slightly closed audience who already speak that language. And so the value for me of professional paid criticism that appears in the mainstream, in whatever format, is that it connects the wider audience to that artwork. And so, you know, like, there's a few different definitions of what a critic is. Like, you know, a critic should be someone who can find out more for you than you can find out for yourself. That's one of them, you know. A critic is a professional audience member. That's another one. You know, the critic should find the story behind the work or whatever. I think the critic, really good critics, operate as a type of bridge, but they don't tell you what to think.
Yeah.
They open up a space in which you can figure out what you think too. So I feel it's a very fluid type of thing, and I would be really concerned if criticism became the preserve of academia, because I think that would exclude that audience. Yeah.
Cool. Okay, that's great. We're out of time, so thank you very much for coming along today. Thank you very much to the audience for checking out as well. It's obvious there is some still interest in critics. We're not a dying species yet. So big thanks to Ian, thanks to Christine, thanks to Nadine, and thanks to Graham. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thanks to Ian, Christine, Graeme and Nadine for joining us at Crinu. And thanks to Zoe, Penny, Rachel and all at Crinu and Dublin Castle for their help with this. This podcast was recorded by Laszlo Vulek and the Bantercast series producer is Tanya White. Check out thisisbanter.com for news of our up-to-date banter. Plus, you can also listen back there to all the banter podcasts to date. We'll be back next week with another podcast. Until then, goodbye and take care.